Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to actor and writer and activist Mike Farrell. You might remember him from his role in the TV series MASH. Right now, I would like to welcome Doyle Preheim. He's the director of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale, who are having their 30th anniversary concert this Sunday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
30th anniversary concert. How long have you been with them?
I came to Santa Fe 5 years ago, and within a year I was appointed musical director. So I've been with the choir now 4 seasons.
What is the nature of the choir? Is it all local people?
It's a community choir, singers from Los Alamos, Santa Fe, and several from Albuquerque. But the majority, by far, are Santa Fe residents.
And so how do you get into this choir? Is it a rigorous audition process?
There is an audition process, as there are openings in a particular section. I contact people to audition, and yes, there is a process by which they have to pass the test.
When you say you contact people, you don't put an ad in the paper. You contact individuals you already know can sing.
I have a waiting list of over 30 names of people who would like to be in the choir, which is a really nice situation to have. And so, and I know which ones of those are sopranos and which ones of those are altos and so on. And so I send them an email or make a telephone call and say, are you still interested? And if they are, then I invite them to audition.
Now, what kind of background do these folks have? I assume they're not professional musicians, or they'd be performing professionally elsewhere.
There are several in the choir who have music degrees, maybe music education, or vocal degrees. But most of them are working people. They work in the labs in Los Alamos, or they're school teachers, or they are business people, educators. So it's quite a broad cross-section of the community, which is a very special thing about the choir. It's in that sense, an amateur group made up of people who just love to sing.
I think it's worth noting every once in a while the etymology of amateur has in it the root word that means love.
That's right. And that's definitely true for this group. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary. There are several people in the choir who are still singing after 30 years.
Really? You've got some of the originals.
We have some charter members, I think the original group of 8, and there are still 2 or 3 of those who are singing.
So when it started, what was the idea? To do classical repertoire or what?
The idea was to do primarily classical repertoire, but they do quite a wide variety of music. We continue to do that. Folk music, classical music, ethnic musics, and occasionally something from Broadway musical. But primarily, I would say, our emphasis is classical.
And so it's men and women, and how many people are in the group?
Currently, we have approximately 50. It varies.
What an incredible sound you can get with 50
That's
people.
Right. That's right. The group had been smaller at one time. I think when they started out, they had about 12 or 14. And over the years, it's just gotten a little larger. And when I came to be director of the group, I decided I was going to make it even just a bit larger because I love the possibilities of sound with a group of about 50. So you can do all the literature. You can do the big romantic pieces of Brahms. And you can also do the madrigals of the Elizabethan period in England. It's a wonderful sound.
We have some pieces that we're going to play for our listeners right now. Let's go into the first one, which is in a language that I don't speak.
Direton. It's in French.
Direton, yeah. Okay.
It's the last number of a group of 5 that Morton Lordson wrote. They become very popular. These Chansons de Rose, the 5 songs, are some of the best-selling songs in the United States and beyond. Right now, they've become very popular with choirs around the world.
And so choirs have their own top 40 smash
hits. Absolutely, and this is one of them. the Sangre de Cristo Chorale has performed the entire cycle, all five songs, twice in their history. And because it's our 30th anniversary, we are inviting alumni to come back and join us. And the first five songs of our program on Sunday will be from that top 40 list of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale. I asked the choir, what would be some of your favorite pieces from the past years? And this was one of them. And so we're just doing the last of the series of five.
Well, let's hear Dirait-on. Dirait-on by Lordson, Morten Lordson. So when you hear a sound, I hear a sound like that, I wonder, how do you teach your singers to blend in such a way that no one singer stands out too much?
Well, that's the goal of every choir, to achieve good blend, good sound. And so you work at things where you emphasize listening to each other and trying to match the sound that your neighbor is making. You work on such things as vowel unison. Everybody's singing the same vowel sounds. If one is singing ah and the other is singing aw, it doesn't blend. And you try to get people to sing at about the same volume. So those are some things we work at in rehearsals, and hopefully by concert time we've achieved a good blend.
Do you find that your singers have to lose some of their habits, and you have to teach them how to do that?
Well, maybe the answer to that is yes. Habits, maybe. I think everyone has their own individual way of singing, and you have to, in a chorus, kind of sublimate your own unique quality to the unique quality that the conductor is trying to get out of the total group. That sometimes is not so easy, but a singer who is sensitive to musical ideas will be able to adjust his or her voice to do that.
Now, this is a recording made some time ago, the one we just heard?
This one was made about 10 years ago, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so the Sangre de Cristo Chorale has been recording for quite a while.
This particular recording is not of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale.
Okay.
I should be clear about that. None of these recordings are performances of our chorale. The Sangre de Cristo Chorale has made three CDs. Our most recent one was issued this last fall and will be available for sale at our concert. So people can come prepared.
And prepared to shell out for a CD.
Exactly.
The concert, by the way, is this Sunday, the 18th of May, at 2:30 at Santa Maria de la Paz Catholic Church on Richards Avenue, which is pretty much across the street from the Santa Fe Community College, a couple of miles down Richards Avenue from Rodeo Road. What are the acoustics like in that building?
I love to perform in Santa Maria de la Paz. They are not quite as live as a cathedral acoustic, yet the acoustics are very warm and friendly for choral music. It's a nice long sanctuary with fairly high ceilings, and so the sound just kind of rolls on and on and on, which choirs love to hear.
Do you suppose that medieval cathedrals were built with the acoustics of their church music in mind?
Hard to say, you know.
I never thought about that.
I think that first and foremost it was a theological architecture reaching to God, you know, these very, very high sanctuaries and ceilings. But coincidentally, it certainly is marvelous for singing.
The next song we're going to hear is Steal Away by Norman Luboff.
That's right. Norman Luboff was one of the giants of choral music in the United States. Several decades ago, and he had a touring group called the Norman Luboff Choir. They toured all over the country and would sing in communities across the country. And he had a special love for folk music and spirituals, and did a lot of arrangements of folk songs and spirituals, and this is a good example of one of the African-American spirituals.
Let's hear it. Happens when chorales like yours do black spirituals. They sound so white.
It's always a struggle, isn't it? even this choir, although I think this choir was University of Southern Mississippi, so they're in the middle of the, in the African-American community, so yeah. Well, it's a dilemma. It's such wonderful music, you know, wonderful, wonderful reservoir of choral music, but a choir like Sangre de Cristo Choral doesn't naturally.
Yeah, well, I mean, what is to be done about that? Because there's something about a black church singing black spirituals that has a. There's nothing wrong with the white way, so to speak. But it's such a different sound. Why is it such a different sound?
I think partly, it's cultural. I'm not sure that.
Is it a technique thing?
It's partly technique. Let's face it, Caucasians just don't have the same sense of rhythm that African Americans have. I don't know if that's something that's learned.
I beg to differ, but anyway.
That's learned in the black church. I mean, I think part of it, it's a learned thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We sit in church, we Caucasians sit in church and sing this very straight four part.
Right.
We don't have the
syncopation thing
That's
built
right.
into the music.
And it's just not in our bones because of the experiences, I think, more than anything else.
Now, you were talking about the songs that your choral, the Sangre de Cristo Choral, has chosen to sing. What makes a song fun to sing and popular for the choirs themselves? And is that the same thing that the audiences also love?
Oh, yes and no. I think that... sing even within the choir. If you ask the 50 people in our choir which of these pieces do they like best, they wouldn't agree. So there's a lot of personal taste, but if a song has a singable melody, a choir will love it. If a song has nice harmonies, lush sounds, a choir will love it. But then there are some singers who would say, but we'd also like to sing some things that are really, really dissonant or really, really modern. So, there's not a unanimity of opinion on that subject. I think this particular group, all of these songs that they have identified as favorites, are very singable. They have lovely melodies and rich harmonies.
Now, speaking of things that must be, I would guess, fun to sing, is the Schubert. We've got some tracks from a Schubert Mass.
Correct. This is a special undertaking for our choir, part of the 30th anniversary emphasis. We very seldom perform with an orchestra. We usually perform with piano accompaniment or a cappella or a small combination of instruments. It's very expensive to hire an orchestra, but once every 30 years, we can do it. So the Schubert Mass is for chorus and an orchestra. We'll have 30 instrumentalists joining us.
Is it a particular orchestra that's playing? It's people you've put together?
It's people that we've put together from the Santa Fe, Albuquerque area. And I will meet them for the first time Friday night. We have only two rehearsals with
the
orchestra.
Goodness.
That is a reason to be biting my nails. But
yes, bite.
But these are professionals, and they will do extremely well.
So tell us a little bit about the Schubert Mass.
Well, the Schubert Mass is one of six masses that Schubert wrote. The first four he wrote were very much shorter in length, and they were written for use in the church service. They were liturgical. The last two masses that he wrote, the one in A-flat major and E-flat major, were much more of concert masses. And this one we're doing is definitely a concert mass. It's about a 55-minute to an hour in length. Of course, it consists of the liturgical texts. It's a bit unique in that it's primarily a choral mass. There are five soloists, but their roles are rather small, not insignificant, but in terms of total time. They don't sing a lot of it, but they have some beautiful, beautiful parts to sing. So that's one of the reasons we chose it. It's a choral mass, and we are a choir, so it gives us lots to do. And I think the choir has learned to love it. It's a very melodic piece, as you would expect from Schubert. He wrote wonderful melodies, and it will be a very fine performance.
And let's hear the Gloria from the Schubert Mass. And we're listening to music that will be performed this Sunday by the Sangre de Cristo Chorale, 30th anniversary concert at 2:30 in the afternoon on Sunday, May 18th at Santa Maria de la Paz Church. Where can people get tickets?
Ticket information, call 455-3707.
455-3707.
Correct. and tickets would also be available at the door.
At the door. And that's a pretty capacious church, not likely to...
There's room for lots of people.
Okay. And this is also something probably that children would enjoy?
I think children of middle school and high school age especially. We wouldn't invite...
The squirming toddlers?
Children under two probably wouldn't enjoy it much.
Doyle Preheim is the director of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with actor Mike Farrell. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Mike Farrell. He is an actor, activist, writer, and biker. His new book is a memoir, Just Call Me Mike, published by Akashic Books. And he will be speaking this evening at 5:30 at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Nice to meet you. So you talk about your childhood growing up in an Irish Catholic family, and it's sort of poignant. I think a lot of people can identify with this, which is that there are a lot of rules about what's right and wrong, but you're not really allowed to ask for clarification on what they are, so you're always kind of bumping against the wall, trying to figure out how to be.
Exactly.
And that gave you, as you said, I mean, do you think that that's part of what made you an actor, because you're always trying to act the right part?
Interestingly, I realized many years later that I was always an actor. Exactly right. I was acting like what I thought I was supposed to be. Without knowing what I was supposed to be, yeah. So you know, the actor, the actual actor part of it came out of a different piece of that, but it was always exactly that. I'm trying to figure out where my feet are supposed to be, how I'm supposed to look, what I'm supposed to be doing, what I'm not supposed to be doing.
Right, right. No, it was so interesting to read that, because unless you have parents who really understand you and want you to come forward, there's always this trying to figure out what the heck the grown-ups are all about. You then went into the Marines, and one of the things that was a place in the book where you describe your realization of how much racism there is. You made friends with a black soldier, and you were a white guy, and that wasn't looked on too kindly. Do you think that was the beginning of your understanding of racial prejudice?
It was one of the most dramatic lessons I had, because it was so personal. But you know, as I thought back about it, when I was raised in West Hollywood before it was a city, and there was a relatively large community of Mexican Americans there then, and we went to school with them, and you know, knew them, were friendly. But when the man at the park formed us into a club, the Mexican kids formed into what the people thought of as a gang. So, you know, there's an awareness of what's going on. You understand the difference between where they live and where we live and all that stuff. But the most dramatic thing for me was the experience with Tyus when I was in the Marines. Yeah, that suddenly I thought, what I'm doing is not okay by these people. And it seems very okay to me. And I'm trying to figure out where, you know, what the story is here. And as you know from the going on, the next step was to drive the car through the South and see these manifestations of racism that I had thought were historic, not in fact contemporary. And so that, you know, it was part of a process, but that was one of the major steps. Yeah.
Tell us more about that trip. Why did you choose to drive through the South? What were you doing?
A friend of mine had joined the Army, and he was in South Carolina at a base, and his folks hired me to drive his car to him, and I just charted out a route, and it took me down through Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, and then up into the Carolinas, because I'd never seen that part of the country. And the stunning thing to me was to see, I mean, we're talking 1959, see black-only and white-only drinking fountains and black-only and white-only restrooms and, you know, and it took me back to the whole situation with Tyus, my friend in the Marines, and I realized if he was with me, he couldn't have been with me. We couldn't do the same things. We couldn't go the same places. It was really a shock, and I guess it's a measure of how naive I was as a kid. To be shocked by that at that time, yet it was a reality for me.
And these things, it apparently set a direction in your life, because your activism has been very sensitive to those kinds of disparities.
Yes, indeed. Well, Yeah, and also a manifestation of my own, you know, discovery. And actually, in doing the book, I really came to the realization that when I was a kid, the, you know, the anger that I really never understood or gave voice to because of the way I was treated, really came about as from what I call, what I've come to realize, I thought of as a kind of disequilibrium of power. There was this power on the part of my father and this lack of power on my part that was utterly unfair. And as a result of that, I think I became really sensitized to the fact that people live that out throughout their lives, some because of their color, some because of their race or religion, some because of their sex, some because of their sexual, you know, orientation. And it infuriates me. I hate it.
We're talking to Mike Farrell. His memoir is called Just Call Me Mike. Now, when you were a young adult, you joined a, I don't know if this is the right word, but self-help organization, for lack of a better word, called The House, which deeply influenced you. What was it about? I mean, it seems that you have these parallel tracks of acting and activism, yeah. And it seems that that experience really helped both of those activities.
Very much so. I think it did more for me as a human being than it did for me as an actor, but it certainly helped me as an actor as well. It came about because I was, you know, going about it trying to figure out how to do right and fell in love with this girl and got married. I thought I was doing what I was supposed to be doing as a young American guy. And the marriage fell apart very shortly. And I was just devastated because it sort of represented, its failure represented the fact that everything I was doing was wrong. And I was utterly emotionally in the pits. And some friends directed me to this place. It was, as you say, a halfway house. It was a place where people from all walks of life, but people who were actually what some would consider the dregs of society, you know, people who were drug addicts and alcoholics and deviates of one form or another, people out of prisons and mental institutions, really, really not the kind of nice people that my parents would have wanted me to associate with, I suppose. But people who had come to a place in their lives where they understood that they had to figure out how to face the truth about themselves, how to learn to tell the truth or die. And it was an astonishingly glorious experience, painful but glorious, in that these folks had learned and they helped me learn about some fundamental values in life and about who I was and about forced me to ask the questions that I'd never asked myself before and confront some realities about myself. And it was an experience that stays with me. It was, you know, what, 40 plus years ago now, but the lessons I learned there stay with me today, and I test them every day and find them to be absolutely true.
Even then, you did a piece of work where you went into prisons and talked to prisoners.
Yeah, well, part of the process of this organization was you came in stupid, and you hopefully went out responsible. So I was part of the stupid group until I learned how to ask for what I wanted and learned about myself and learned how to be honest and learned how to deal with some reality. And then when you became responsible, you gave back. You led groups, you went into the prisons and talked to people there about coming out and coming to a program rather than going back to their old way of life. So going into prisons was a real eye-opener for me. And
you got attacked by, or almost attacked by somebody the first moment you were there.
Yeah, well, those challenges happen all the time. I think of some of the studies that I've seen about scientists working in the wild with the animals, and particularly gorillas, and you do certain things and you don't do certain things. Well, and the same thing is true in prisons. You do certain things and you don't do certain things. And this guy came at me and he wanted to prove himself somehow manly, and I didn't play his game. Because I had learned not to play his game.
I was reading that passage and I thought, were you able to just look into his eyes and stand your ground because you'd done the training in the house, or because you were a Marine?
Well, I suppose having been a Marine, there's a knowledge that you can take care of yourself. But in that, it was the house. I mean, they really taught me that I could simply respond appropriately in situations and didn't have to resort to physical violence or whatever, even though I had the capacity to do it if I needed to.
So you were taking part in activism of all kinds. You were involved in political movements from the Biafran situation in the late 60s, Cesar Chavez, the defense of Daniel Ellsberg, Central American solidarity groups. And there's a couple of times in the book where you kind of talk about the contrast between, and you were also a professional actor, so that between the world of acting and glamour and the insincerity that's there, and then this kind of straightforward relative egolessness of these political movements. What was that like to be living in both worlds?
Well, you said something interesting at the beginning about the house, and that it helped me become an actor. Bill Cousins, who the doctor who was the sort of ran the place, he was a psychologist and was just an extraordinary man, said to me at one point during the process of being there, he said, you know, this is not the reason for you to be here, but if you go through this process, it'll make you a better actor. And he was quite right, because it taught me the difference between reality and non-reality, and gave me tools with which to draw on things that have served me as an actor.
I mean, you actually used the word something about taking off your masks, and
yes.
Of course, acting, you have to know what the mask is and
exactly.
What the reality is underneath that.
Exactly right. But what a lot of people don't comprehend is that they are living behind masks all the time, and that I was, you know, and that when I realized I could shed that mask and still find myself, at least to myself, acceptable and present that face and find people who would accept me for it, it was a really liberating experience. So having that understanding, having that kind of fundamental grasp of what life is about, then helped me understand what pretending was about and how much pretending I had been doing, and that I could use that ability to pretend professionally. But life was a whole other thing. And when I went into places like what you're talking about in refugee camps or prisons or some of the horrible places I've been, that's life. You know, that's real life. And sometimes it's difficult to step from one to the other and step back. And kind of keep your feet on the ground, keep your head about you, and try not to be just a totally destroyed by it on some level. But it also just is hugely strengthening. It really allows you to appreciate what's real here, and not what's not real here. And on some levels, I guess it makes me a little short-tempered about some things.
We're talking to Mike Farrell. His memoir is called Just Call Me Mike, and he will be speaking this evening at 5:30 at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Now, you acted in soap opera and other TV roles, and then you became an international star with your role as Captain B.J. Honeycutt in MASH,
yeah.
Which probably a lot of the people who are listening today know. I mean, I still watch it on one of the Dish Network rerun channels. Did your role as a suddenly high-profile actor make your political work more effective? Were you able to do more because of that?
Well, I don't know about more effective is a hard concept for me to deal with, but... you know, I was doing the same things I'd been doing before, but
yeah.
Before I was carrying a sign or walking in a group or speaking to small organizations and small groups, and suddenly, as a result of the fact that, as you say, I became known internationally because of my association with this show, the opportunities expanded, and I suppose the ability to reach out expanded, as well as the impact of what I was doing. So it's hard to sort of... claim credit for what I'm doing, but what I'm doing seems to me to be right and fundamentally appropriate and necessary, so I just kept doing it.
I really enjoyed reading the section on your work with MASH. It sounds like a wonderful moment where the directors actually listened to the actors,
yeah.
The actors got along well, and it sounded like really... an incredibly wonderful working experience.
It was bliss. It really was. And having been, as you suggested, I'd been on, you know, a soap and two primetime television series and then through any number of projects and under contract at a studio. And I'd been around the business for a while before I came to MASH. And the difference was night and day. The difference was, as you suggest, here were people who were in a collegial situation, people who saw each other as equals and as respected professionals and treated each other that way, instead of thinking actors are dumb as stumps and should get out of the way or are pieces of furniture that need to be moved and disregarded otherwise.
That's pretty amazing that anybody does treat you that way in the first place.
Oh,
the craft of acting is so incredibly admirable.
Well, thank you very much. A lot of people don't think so. But aside from that, you know, there are people in the business, in my end of the business, or in the acting end of the business, I should say, that really aren't particularly nice folks and aren't all that smart in some instances. They happen to look right or they, excuse me, they happen to look right or they fit the bill and they get the job and then their heads swell hugely and then they begin to behave like children. So actors get a bad name, sometimes legitimately, sometimes for good reason, although it shouldn't apply to everybody because they're not all that way. There are a lot of deeply good, solid, professional people who, as you say, have learned their craft and learned it well and are able to do the work. But the business is—it's a business, first of all, and it categorizes people. And actors are not highly regarded in the business.
And in this situation, they were asking you to read the script and comment on it.
In this situation, it was very different. Actors were very highly regarded and respected. And so, yeah, you know, whereas before I'd be given a script and expected to do exactly what was in the script, and if I had a comment or a concern about it, most people didn't want to hear it. In this situation, they asked for it. We sat around the table on the first day of my work on MASH and read the script, and it was wonderful. And then the director said, okay, page one. And I looked at him like, what do you mean? And he said, oh, Mike, here we go through it page by page, and we want to hear if you have any comments or questions or concerns or things, suggestions. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Now, do you feel that your experience as a Marine made you be able to play the part better? You mentioned in the beginning that of the book that some of the during your service you encountered conditions that were kind of like what you played later in MASH, except without the comedy.
Exactly right. Yeah, I lived in a tent in the Marines. I lived in Okinawa in very lousy physical conditions. And sure, having been in the service is different from not having been in the service. So there was a reality that that I think gave me a leg up. But on the other hand, except for Jamie Farr, who played Colonel Corporal Klinger, nobody else had been in the service in the cast, and it didn't harm them. You know, they were able to act the situation. And the doctors in the military are really not the most military of usually most military of types. So the kind of snap that's required in the Marine Corps, you know, the bunks well made and the turned out uniforms and everything spit shined and looking good, none of that was the reality on MASH.
Right, which is one of the things that made it so appealing.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Now, I was thinking as I was reading it about this Irish, strict Irish Catholic, you know, unforgiving God that you grew up with, and then a kind of compassionate God that seems to be the spiritual center in a lot of the activist work that you do. I don't know if it's that way for you personally, but I wondered if you felt like your strict church background laid a foundation for you for your activist work or not.
Well, you can't, I think, you can't come through that experience, the experience of being raised in a strict Catholic household, without having it affect you for the rest of your life. But you have to mold it, you know. And I think there is some residue, if you will, of that in my outlook. I've moved away from Catholicism, but I have tremendous respect for people, for example, that I met in Central America, the liberation theologians, and the priests and nuns who have given their lives on the altar of social justice. I mean, those people to me are really what religion is about. So, sure, there's some carryover. I'm just not real clear about what it all is.
Yeah, it's worth contemplating because there's so many different things that people mean when they say God.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us more about your trips to Central America. They were really life-changing for you.
They were, yeah. My first trip abroad was for Concern America, this refugee aid organization I'd become involved with, and it was to Southeast Asia, to the place where the Khmer Rouge had done such horror been routed by the Vietnamese, and the Khmer people were trying to get out of their country when the war was going on. The United Nations tried to help them because the Thais wouldn't let them across the border, so there was this huge camp that Concern and a number of other international refugee aid organizations went into. But the difference there was that I didn't see the direct connection between U.S. involvement and what had happened, although I think there was a significant U.S. connection, I'd learned later. In Central America, where I went 2 years later, in 82, I think I went the first time, I saw that the people who flooded out of El Salvador and Guatemala, in particular El Salvador, were victimized by U.S. foreign policy. And that really came home to me in a very personal way, you know, because, if you take it down to dollars and cents, my tax dollars are being paid to prop up this government that was waging war on its own people, killing people, torturing people, doing things that are savage.
Not to mention teaching people to do that killing.
Indeed, here, right, in the School of the Americas, teaching torture and teaching the kind of brutality that these people were visiting on their own citizens. So that brought it home to me in a very personal and deeply meaningful way, and I got very involved then with what grew to be the human rights movement. After seeing the situation outside El Salvador, I went into El Salvador with human rights organizations and confronted the people there, confronted the military, and confronted the government, and came back and confronted the U.S. government about what it was doing and what it was responsible for. And we were called communists, of course, and all the chosen phrases of the day to try to demonize people. And I went back into the country and into Nicaragua as well a number of times during the 80s with these different delegations and with sometimes in individual situations to try and find ways to help. And also coming back here to try and gin up the movement against U.S. involvement, particularly in Central America, which was being promoted by the Reagan administration. So that was a real... a really interesting and educational experience.
And then you went into anti-death penalty work.
Yeah, kind of at the same time. All of these things are linked as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. It's really all about whether people are valued or not.
And the people who are the least able to defend themselves.
Of course, sure, sure. And having been at the house and having been seen, gone into prisons as part of that program and seeing the dehumanizing aspects of the way in which people are treated in those places, it became clear to me that there are people who never had the opportunity that I did, never had the opportunity that was given those at the house to take stock of their lives and try to do something about it. And that once people are incarcerated, once people are put away for doing something wrong, as far as society is concerned, we have the opportunity as a society to give them that, to teach them, to habilitate them, as was said by one of the guys at the house. But instead of doing that, we're so busy punishing and dehumanizing that we forget all about, you know, all the good things we could do. And it seems to me that the death penalty is the kind of worst aspect of that. It's where we take these people, shackle them, keep them behind bars where they're helpless, and then at the appointed time trot them out and crucify them.
And you were involved in that amazing phenomenon that happened in Illinois, where the governor of Illinois basically suspended the death penalty because of the incredible abuses.
Yes, indeed. Governor Ryan, a hero as far as I'm concerned, and continues to be a hero, though he is today in jail. He self-described conservative, Republican death penalty supporter, saw that more people had been exonerated, convicted, tried, convicted, sentenced to death, and ultimately found to be not guilty of the crime for which they were about to be killed, and released, than had been killed by his system. He said, something's wrong here, and we have to look at it. So he stopped it. He declared a moratorium on the death system. And set up a commission to investigate it. And that commission, made up of death penalty supporters and opponents, said, after looking at it for 2 years, it's not working.
Now, I was the word progressive has the connotation of progress, and you know, when I think of all the years in which you've done activism, one might think that there's been a kind of regress when you look at the war in Iraq and its parallels to the war in Vietnam and the incredible movements backwards in social services and so on. How do you see that right now? I mean, do you feel like, where do you think our country is at?
Well, we're in a very difficult place right now. But I think what it is reactionary behavior. We are making progress, and we continue to make progress. And as we do, the forces of negativity, if you will, become more and more frightened, and they are therefore more and more active. And they've been very active, and successfully so, in electing the Ronald Reagans and electing the George Bushes, because they have learned ways to frighten the American people and use their fear against them. So-called war on terror is probably the best example of that. You know, using the terrible thing that happened on September 11th to disarm the American people, to strip them of their rights. So I see it as a reactionary response to the good that we have done and the movement forward that the liberal or progressive or democratic or whatever you want to call it movement in this country has done. And it's going to be a continuing struggle. But I think the goal is a country that lives up to the fundamental principles that we all sort of know about but don't pay much attention to often enough.
And quite a strong constitution that we have to work with.
Indeed. One that's been done great harm by the current administration.
Mike Farrell is an actor, activist, writer, and biker, and we haven't had a chance to talk about the biker thing yet, but it's pretty much time to go. His new memoir is called Just Call Me Mike. It's published by Akashic Books, and he will be speaking this evening at 5:30 at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe on West San Francisco Street, right across from the Lenzic Theater. Mike Farrell, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to meet you, and nice to be talking to you. Thank you.
You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features an extended cut from the Bob Belden CD, Miles from India. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Ciao.